Just pray with me for a moment. Father, I thank you for your faithfulness. I thank you for a beautiful day. And I thank you for all the precious people gathered here. And every precious person that's at home that may be listening, and anyone that we don't know that might be listening in whatever part of the world they might be in. I ask you to bless them right now where they are, and I ask you to bless each person here right where they're sitting, and I ask you once again, Father, for your help, and I ask you to use me in whatever way you would like here. I receive your grace, and I thank you for your faithfulness in Yeshua's name. Amen. So I thought I'd mention. Does anyone know what the after a portion that was read today is called, or what it's about, or why it doesn't necessarily directly relate to the Torah portion? Anyone know? I heard one answer, but it came from behind me. I heard a voice. Anybody have an answer? Well, it's the second haftarah of affliction or admonition. And does anyone know why? What? My son says because the first one already happened. So yes, that he is absolutely correct, even if it's not exactly what I was asking. So last week was the first haftarah of affliction or admonition, and so of course this week was the second one, and next week there will be a third one. And can anyone tell me how many there are? What? Three, excellent guess. And then they're followed by seven haftarot of consolation. Who likes consolation? Who anyone like consolation better than affliction? Not sure. Some of you aren't sure which one you like better. I think I like consolation better than I like affliction myself. So anyway, these haftarah portions have to do with they start after the 17th of Tammuz, and then they go they're between the 17th of Tammuz and the 9th of Av. Anyone know what the 9th of Av was? Well, in rabbinic tradition, Tisha B'Av, or the 9th of the month of Av, is classical. In classical Judaism, it's actually the most solemn fast day of the whole year, more solemn than Yom Kippur. Now, there's debate about whether or not that should actually be considered that way, but that's what one flow of tradition says. And it's because, at least in terms of tradition, the temple, Solomon's temple, was destroyed on the 9th of Av. And then the second temple was also destroyed on the 9th of Av, according to tradition. And the fast of Tammuz marks the first breach of the wall. So the period of time, these 3 weeks, is known as Ben Ha Mitzarim, not Mitzrayim, which means between the breaches. There are times when the walls of Jerusalem were breached. And so the Neo-Babylonians destroyed Solomon's temple, and then later, that was in 586 BC, and then in 70 AD, the Romans destroyed the second temple. So it's a pretty bad pretty bad day, you know, when the temple's destroyed, don't you suppose? So it's a time of mourning, but and the Haftarot of affliction basically bring to mind the offenses of Israel against the Lord, and there's some pretty harsh language. I'm not sure how much worse it could get than for God's beloved Israel to be compared to a donkey in heat that anybody that comes along can sleep with. That's pretty bad. I don't know how much farther you can go than that. So, but then comes the Haftarot of consolation, and then there are hints of hope and of turning and of redemption. So I'm just going to read you a little bit of the comments on this week's Haftarot here. The main part of this Haftarah, this week's Haftarah, is an extensive indictment of the widespread faithlessness, ingratitude, and apostasy addressed to the entire nation. A reference to political alliances with Assyria and Egypt seems to fit the final decades of the Judean state, when such attempts were made for the sake of protection against the Neo-Babylonian Empire. Otherwise, the accusations are without reference to specific events. The harsh judgment of the Haftarah is counterposed by brief words of hope and renewal from Jeremiah 3:4 and 4:1-2. According to the traditions of the Ashkenazim and Sephardim, respectively. The first conclusion of the Haftarah is a remarkable counterpoint to an accusation. God's hopeful statement that the people have now called him Father thoroughly reverses the earlier avowal of wood as my father. Can you imagine calling wood your father? You get the reference, right? You carve a little figure out of wood and decorate it however you want and tack it down so it won't fall over, and then you bow down and call it Father. I don't know. I mean, if my kids did that, I think it would be kind of an affront to me. If they said, "You're not our dad. This chunk of wood is our dad." How do you suppose the Lord feels when his people, his chosen people, act that way? And it seems in some ways fitting to me this year that these come along at the time when they do, when it seems like there's some trouble in our country, don't you think? Now, I don't know if I remember a time in my life when I didn't think there was any trouble in our country. I kind of came of age during a time of lots of upheaval, and I think I was greatly affected by upheaval that sort of really began before my memory starts. So there just seems like there's always been a lot of trouble, but right now we have a lot going on, and the world is full of experts about everything, and politicians who know exactly what to do, who are absolutely diametrically opposed to each other, and it seems like many people are drawing lines and declaring sides and cursing people as their enemies, and it seems also that a lot of God's people, those who name the name of Messiah I'm referring to, are putting their faith in alliances that could be called political. So let's just say that parts of the body of Messiah have, figuratively speaking, made alliances with Assyria, maybe, and Egypt, and other means by which perhaps they feel that they can protect themselves and save the day. But these words are to Israel, and the promises of the prophets are to Israel first, and none of these things should be co-opted and taken over as though it's all been snatched away from Israel. The word of God makes it clear that God will never forsake his people Israel, and that they can't be spiritualized into a body of persons that are just gathered from all over the world who aren't part of Israel. But the promise is for Israel, to Israel, and then to all the nations through Israel. And so ultimately God is looking for restoration, the establishment of righteousness, and to make all humanity into one single new humanity in perfection, in fellowship with each other and with him. So the promise ultimately is to everyone. And so there's plenty to go around. Nobody needs to be jealous. There seems to be a lot of jealousy and a lot of desire for retribution in the world. People want to get revenge. They want to get, I don't know. I've heard people during the course of my life, many people ask, say that they just want what they have coming. And normally when I'm in a conversation and somebody says that, depends on the context, but it's like, well, I tell them, well, I'm really glad I'm not going to get what I have coming. Because if I got what I had coming, if things were fair, I'd be in a very sorry state. But because God doesn't do things in a way that's based on fairness, those who don't deserve his love get loved. Those who don't deserve to be cleansed get cleansed. Those who don't deserve redemption are redeemed. And the blood of the precious Messiah, the Son of God, is poured out for the sake of people who, even at that moment, were his enemies and people who would be his enemies in ages to come. It was poured out, and so it's made available, and anyone who calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved. So these haftarot of affliction, they speak of the dangers of apostasy, of greed, envy, false alliances, idolatry. And ultimately, if we read them in a personalized way, they speak to us about where our affections go. If any of our affection is going to some place other than the Lord, if we're drifting, if we're beginning to love the world rather than the Lord. And so we can find personal admonition and declarations of hope as we read it, even as we understand that these things are spoken to Israel and the promises that are contained in the prophets are given to Israel, and that the promise to all of us, whether we're Jew, Greek, Norwegian, Chinese, Native American, Filipino, or anyone else in all the world, that there is promise for all of us in this. And all persons are of equal value and made in the image of God. So anyway, that's a little bit about, I don't know, how many of you didn't know anything about the haftarot of affliction? Okay. So that's a little bit. And when I see that coming, I always think, oh, the fall feast must be coming 5 minutes after, even though it's actually quite a bit longer. Rosh Hashanah this year, I think, is September 18th, am I correct? So it's more than 5 minutes away, but anytime I think there's time, I've come to say, whenever you think you got time, time is up. And the corollary to that is what one of my old foremen used to say. His name was Bill Hoeger. He'd say, he said a lot of things. I just got my halftime warning. Well, he would say, I've been 3 minutes behind all day. And that little statement is packed with way more meaning than is even possible. But if you're actually behind by 3 minutes and you can't catch up, like really, you're just behind. You're behind. And you run faster and faster. And no matter what you do, how much you scramble, you're still behind. And then when he wasn't happy with somebody, I'll just throw this in as a bonus. He used to say, if something like, if you were my kid, I'd trade you for an old yeller mutt and then I'd shoot the mutt. Don't talk like that to your kids or anybody else. That's free advice. So moving along. My message today, it might have two titles. If it does, the first one is, what do you have in the house? And the second one is, bring me another vessel. After quite a long time, I don't know how long it's been, I just started reading through the book of 2 Kings. And I don't know why I didn't start with 1 Kings. I just started reading 2 Kings again. And it's just packed. But when I got to the fourth chapter, this is very familiar. Probably won't refer to any scriptures that aren't very familiar. Maybe they're all very familiar, I hope so. But there's this, starting at the sixth verse of the fourth chapter of 2 Kings, is, now a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, "Your servant, my husband, is dead." That must really mean something of gravity, right? "And you know that your servant feared the Lord." And that is, again, something of gravity. That's it's a claim to something, right? Does it sound that way? "And the creditor has come to take my two children to be his slaves." Elisha said to her, "What shall I do for you?" Now I want to ask you to imagine just anybody coming to you with a predicament and telling you about it, and then saying, "What shall I do for you?" Can you imagine that? "What shall I do for you?" He says, "What shall I do for you?" And then he says, "Tell me, what do you have in the house?" And she said, "Your maidservant has nothing in the house except a jar of oil." Then he said, "Go borrow vessels." You all know this really well, right? Go borrow vessels at large. What does that mean, vessels at large? Go borrow vessels at large for yourself from all of your neighbors, even empty vessels. Do not get a few. What does that mean, do not get a few? It doesn't mean get less than a few, right? Okay, not a few. "And you shall go in and shut the door behind you and your sons and pour out into all these vessels, and you shall set aside what is full." So she went from him and shut the door behind her and her sons. They were bringing the vessels to her, and she poured. When the vessels were full, she said to her son, "Bring me another vessel." And he said to her, "There is not one vessel more." And the oil stopped. Then she came and told the man of God, and he said, "Go sell the oil and pay your debt, and you and your sons can live on the rest." It's a remarkable account, right? And what do we learn from this? God will provide, yeah. that's good. So here's the progression. A certain woman was in a predicament, right? She cried out. Why did she cry out? Well, number one, her husband was dead. I assume that in this case that means that the livelihood that he provided was no longer there, and she was quite behind in whatever the bills were, and kind of helpless in terms of getting out of the predicament. And so problem two is even worse. The creditor is going to take her children away as slaves to pay the debt. That's pretty horrible. What would you think if somebody came along and said, oh, you can't pay? Well, I'm going to take your kid then as a slave. What, how would you feel? Not very good. I think that's what I heard somebody say. So it sounds like a terrible problem. Then there's a question. I mean, she's in debt. She can't pay. Her children are going to be taken as slaves. And the prophet that she cries out to says, what do you have in the house? What kind of a question is that? It's like, what do you mean, what do I have in the house? Like I got nothing. That's why I'm crying out to you. And she didn't say that, but that's like, oh, what do you have in the house? So, here's the thing. Things don't always happen exactly the same way, but in this case and in many other cases, the problem will be solved by means of the inadequate nature of what you have. What do you think? You might think my intellect is inadequate. You might think my bank account is inadequate. You might think my car doesn't even run. I don't have anything I can sell to pay the bill to get it fixed. I can't pay to have the leaky roof fixed. I don't have anything. And so you cry out. Crying out is good. Anybody here ever in trouble and not cry out? I'm amazed. Oh, somebody has. It seems to be fairly common that people are in quite a fix in many different ways. And even though they just told somebody they met on the street about God and his provision, they're not crying out themselves. You ever noticed that? You ever seen that happen? Have you ever done it yourself? Well, so he says, what do you have in the house? And it seems that he's asking because the solution to the problem is in some way going to come by means of what's in the house, but not exactly because there's enough in the house, right? So this is a description of what today I'm calling God's impractical approach to practical problems. You ever find God's approach is impractical, at least from a human standpoint? He wants to come through in a way that doesn't make any sense, that isn't normal, that you can't like just reason out. And he likes to do it in a way that we can't exactly take any credit for having manufactured ourselves. Have you noticed that? Does anybody mind here, like, I mean, if somebody is just honest and generous, anyone here mind if somebody just, like, gives you money? Anybody mind? Yeah, I mean, some people mind. But if somebody whose heart is perfectly pure just comes along and just says, I have this money, I just want to give it to you, how many mind? Okay, it's apparently not too many of us. But, I had a friend long ago who, if we'd go and do things together and sometimes he'd pay for something, you know, it could be something to drink or, I don't know, maybe something to eat. And then on occasions where I tried to pay, he wouldn't let me. And you know what he told me? Why? He said, I don't want to owe anybody anything. By implication, it was fine if I owed him, but he didn't want to owe me. But if I had paid for something, I wouldn't have thought in any way that he owed me anything anyway. All the more so because he would pay for things when we went here or there, and so if anybody owed anybody, it would have been me. But, you know, we have reasons for not wanting to receive something from someone, and sometimes maybe we don't want to receive something from God, even maybe while we're saying that we do. So, anyway, the answer is, what do you have in the house? She says, I have a jar of oil. I imagine like a 16-ounce jar or maybe 1 liter, right? And so then he says, borrow lots of empty vessels. Her sons bring lots of empty vessels. And then she does what she was told to do. She pours. And it just pours and pours and pours and pours and pours until there aren't any more empty vessels. Now, anybody here an empty vessel? I mean, it's a trick question like most questions. But if you are an empty vessel, is there a way to get filled up? And the Lord fills empty people, right? And what does he fill them for? What? You know, I was in a certain town yesterday that's within the bounds of the state of New York. It's an undisclosed location. And in this location, within very few feet, there were really, really, really rich people and people with almost nothing. It was kind of astounding. But this is the basic thing that I noticed. There were people of every shade of color. And there were people with lots of money, and there were people without much. And I think some of those categories were resented by people of various shades of color, too. It wasn't just one side had money and the other didn't. But what I kind of noticed and what I saw while I was there was I just saw what appeared to be lots of empty vessels. Just empty vessels. And so this isn't exactly the same, but although we do find ourselves in predicaments, right, where we feel that we don't have what we need, where we can't make it. Whether it's money, energy, all kinds of human problems. But we've been filled up with something when we came to the Lord, which he says he fills us with his Spirit. He says, be being filled. And the promise for those that come to Messiah is, but something like a river of life will come gushing out of your belly, out of your insides. I don't know, where is it actually supposed to come out? I mean, like your navel or mouth or where? River of living water. It's more than you need what you're filled up with, right? But sometimes we feel kind of dry and almost like we don't have anything. And you know, sometimes I think we're spiritually, we're just like this widow. We don't have much, or we don't think we have much. And so we kind of feel like we don't have anything to give. We might even feel like we want to be useful, but maybe we're afraid we can't be. And you know what I think? I mean, it's not just one thing that's needed. We need to seek the Lord. We need to spend time with him. We don't need to have a perfect devotional life. And we don't need to read 10 times more scripture than we normally do. Might be fine if we read a little more. We don't have to pray 100 times more than we're praying, though it might be good if we prayed more. But mostly, I think we need to cry out and let the Lord know if we feel empty. And then there's this amazing thing that happens. If you find empty vessels, and I'm talking about people, and you start tipping the jar that you have over empty people, if we're in the flow of things and we're sensing God's heart and his love for humanity, if we take the time to notice the people that are walking by or that, you know, actually we end up relating with in some way, there'll be opportunity to pour from what we feel we don't have. Like we may think we can't even pay our debt. We don't even have what we need. We need to serve the Lord, right? But if we have a little jar of oil and there's an empty vessel, you pour it, and that empty vessel can be filled up. And if, I mean, we don't borrow human beings, but in a figurative sense, right? What we should do is we should gather as many vessels as we possibly can, right? And then pour. Not because we have more than a liter, but because the Lord says, well, if you came to me, I'd fill you up with this river. Life will come gushing out of you. The reason for the river, I mean, what do people have, what are springs for? Are they just for the spring to be full of water? Some of them flow. They just flow out. They just keep coming out. What defines a spring? It's not that there's water down there somewhere. It's the water's coming out, right? And some of them just run and run in the water. I don't know. I guess it finds its way to a tributary and it ends up maybe in the river and it, you know, goes on the circuit that water goes through in the earth. But a spring isn't full of water just for itself. Springs were meant to give the thirsty drink. And we're turned into springs when we come to the Lord. And we're meant to pour out into other people. And, you know, we'll meet empty vessels that don't want to be filled up with whatever, anything other than the emptiness they're already filled up with. That's not up to us. But this widow just did a simple thing. She cried out. And I'm talking about both our own practical needs and our desire and need, actually, to be useful to the Lord, because he makes us useful. He says he'll make us fruitful. It's what he does. It's what happens if we abide in him. And we can have the desire sometimes of feel like we can't actually accomplish anything. It's a head game. It's always a head game. The enemy wants to get us thinking that we're inadequate. Well, the good news is that's the best kind of person, because that's what God uses. A liter of oil is not adequate to get your kids out of slavery and pay your bills and bring things back to a state of equilibrium. But God says, well, just borrow a whole bunch of empty vessels and tip that thing and just keep pouring. And you know what? It just keeps on pouring until, if they could have gotten more vessels, I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe there would have been so much oil there wasn't enough room left in town for the people to live there anymore. You know, it stopped only because there wasn't another empty one. The Lord wants to fill a great throng of humanity with his precious oil, the oil of joy and gladness, of redemption and provision. And I think there are a lot of empty vessels around. There's lots and lots and lots of them. There are a lot of them around here. And I think we should be praying for empty vessels to fill up. Praying for them, asking for them, and then not worrying that there won't be anything in the jar, but just trusting the Lord to supply the flow that won't run out as long as there's something, someone to fill up. And so with the little bit of time that I don't have left, what time is it actually? Do we have an end time for today? So this woman, she did an important thing. She cries out to the man of God, and he gives her the most impractical advice, and God comes through by meeting every need with the totally inadequate thing that she had. And that's just what he does with people. Who here is adequate to redeem anybody? Who's inadequate? Anybody adequate to redeem anybody? I'm inadequate. We're all inadequate, but God's adequate. And one of the biggest things that's necessary is empty vessels. They don't seem to be in short supply. And maybe we should ask more for empty vessels to fill. Not that we fill them, but that God will supply the flow. And there's something about being caught up in that endeavor that changes how you feel, changes how you see, changes your sense of what matters the most. And you could find yourself satisfied by things that don't have anything to do with what you thought you wanted and what you were sure you needed, but that just knowing God and letting him use you to pour out, it is kind of the meaning of life, relationship with him and then relationship with others. So in Mark 6, chapter 6, it says, just starting in the middle of nowhere here, people saw Yeshua and his disciples going somewhere, right? And many recognized them and ran there together on foot from all the cities and got where they were going ahead of them. You know, I don't know, they may have had different reasons, but can you imagine knowing where the Lord's going to be? He's everywhere. He's omnipresent, right? But running there and getting there before he got there. They must have really been motivated, these people. They all had needs. Some of them, maybe they just wanted to be fed. On one occasion, that's what is said to these people. But anyway, they got there before them, and he says he saw a large crowd and he felt compassion. Have you ever seen a large crowd and felt compassion? I have, and there are other times I haven't. There are times when I've asked the Lord to fill me with compassion. And I remember times I felt so much of it, I couldn't even deal with it. And then, quite literally just overcome by it. And then times when it's like, man, what's wrong with you, Lundgren? You feel anything? You got a pulse? What's wrong with you? And the Lord knows, by the way, that we live within narrow bounds of temperature and hunger and thirst and all of that, and that we're really frail and we're but dust. He knows, so, and he has compassion on us. And he put compassion in us for other people and make it possible for us to do what we can't do with the little that we think we don't have in ways that don't make any sense, because that's what he does. So anyway, he felt compassion for them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. Well, this sounds like empty vessels. And he began to teach them, teach them many things. When it was already quite late, his disciples came to him and said, "This place is desolate, and it is already quite late. Send them away so that they may go into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat." But he answered them, "You give them something to eat." You probably remember me talking about this before over the years. "So you give them something to eat." And they said to him, "Shall we go and spend 200 denarii on bread and give them something to eat?" Which I don't think it would have been enough. That's the impression I've gotten. And he said to them, "How many loaves do you have?" And then he says, "Go look." So here's where it gets hard. The Lord kind of asked you a question, how much do you have? You know it's not enough, right? But then he says, go look. That's the hard part. You got to go look, even though you already know the answer. You following me? Why go look? Can anybody tell me why? Well, sometimes it is just because he said so. Go and look. So anyway, they went and found out. And when they found out, they said, 5 loaves and 2 fish. And he commanded them to sit down by groups on the green grass. They sat down in groups of hundreds and of fifties, and he took the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, and looking up toward heaven. Now, in this case, it says he blessed the food. When do you bless the food instead of blessing Father who provided it? When it needs to feed way more people than it can. Right? I mean, there's jokes about this, I guess, what they say. Christians bless the food, Jews bless the Father who provided the food. But it's not that simple. But that sometimes people talk about that. But do we really need to bless the food? I mean, when we give thanks, we thank the Father who provided it, right? Unless you've seen Tim Hawkins, who, you know, he prays that the Cheetos will somehow be made, the molecular structure will be changed so it won't do the damage it's going to do, which, you know, seems like a frivolous prayer, but it's kind of funny. So anyway, go and look. They go and look. They tell him how much. It's not nearly enough. This is after he says, you give them something. And this one simple sentence, you give them something, I'm leaving off to eat, but I can leave it on. That one sentence just, it comes rippling through my life every now and then. I just hear it. You give them something. And so I know a couple of things. I know, well, it must be possible to give them something. And then I know that I don't always feel like I can, even though I know it's possible. And I don't know if that's actually literally self-doubt or if it's, is it doubt in Abba? Sometimes it's tricky to tell. But it's Abba we're asking, it's Abba we're crying out to, it's Abba who says he'll make us fruitful and asks us to tell the truth. And so he doesn't ask us to do things we can't do. And he doesn't give us tasks that aren't going to be accomplished. So, anyway, you give them something. Sometimes I just kind of feel it when I'm watching people and not even really having an opportunity. It's like, wow, these people need something. They need to be given something. Somebody needs to give them something. Somebody needs them to give them what they need. Sometimes I'm thinking, well, is it me? Should I just start praying? Should I come back here on another occasion and just find out if I can tip the jar and fill up empty vessels? I mean, sometimes things like this go through my mind. So anyway, so he blessed the food, it says, and broke the loaves, and he kept giving it to them. It sounds just like what happened with the widow, except here we got human vessels that are empty and they need to eat. And he just keeps breaking it and giving it to them. And it just keeps on coming until they're all of them are satisfied. And it says that the men there were 5,000. What the total number of people was then, I don't know. Much larger than that. They all ate until they were filled. From 5 little loaves of bread and 2 little fish, and then there were, 12 baskets of broken pieces, and also of the fish. And so, here's the pattern. to see the practical reality. Well, I don't know. Is it practical to notice that people need redemption? I think so. It's more than practical, but it's certainly got to at least be practical, right? It's what people need the most. But they also have needs that are simply physical, practical needs. And sometimes, if nothing is done for those, we're just like a clanging cymbal. The scriptures tell us not to say, oh, bless you, be warmed and filled, and then go away feeling like we did a favor by just speaking empty words to people. If you speak empty words to somebody that's hungry and walk away, they're still hungry. They haven't been fed. So, but we have the word of truth, and we have the one that is the light that came into the world living in us. And so we cannot be truly empty of something to pour. And though we may feel like it, we can ask, we can cry out, and we can ask for empty vessels. We can ask the Lord for empty vessels. I don't know how you go around borrowing people, but think about it. How to get empty vessels to fill up, and then being ready to fill them, ready to tip the jar. The old widow didn't do anything real complicated. She just picked it up and tipped it over each empty vessel, and it just kept flowing until everything was filled. And the gospel is like that, right? It never runs out. It's never expended so that there isn't enough left for another empty vessel, is it? Never. So, you see the practical reality and tell the Lord about it. We'll ask. He'll ask us what entirely inadequate means we have to apply to the huge need, the gaping hole, the insurmountable problem, right? He asks us to pour out of the limitations of the situation at hand. That little jar of oil was absolutely, completely limited and powerless to get that widow out of the fix that she was in. But God says to take what's inadequate and what won't work and what doesn't make any sense, and just begin to pour. He may say, go and look, after we tell him we don't have anything or we don't have much. And then he'll supply all that is needed to fill every empty vessel that we can borrow, find, and bring near to the source. And it will pour until all the vessels are filled, until all the hungry are fed. This is the message we have heard from him and announced to you, that God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all. We say we have fellowship with him and yet walk in the darkness, we lie and do not practice the truth. But if we walk in the light, as he himself is in the light, we have fellowship with one another. Isn't that amazing? We walk in the light as he is in the light. You'd almost expect it to say you have fellowship with him. It says we're doing that, we have fellowship with one another. And the blood of Yeshua, his son, cleanses you from all sin. You have fellowship with one another. You have fellowship with God. You walk in the light with the one who is the light that came into the world. If we say we have no sin, we are deceiving ourselves, and the truth is not in us. If we confess our sins, he is faithful and righteous to forgive us our sins and to wash away all of the stuff that we think we are indelibly stained with, and make us clean. If we say we have not sinned, we make him a liar, and his word is not in us. But anybody here saying they have not sinned? Speak now or nobody. So I just want to remind us all today that we've been bought out of slavery. The jar of oil that looked like just one simple man to the world was tipped and poured, and it filled this person and that person and person after person and kept on filling people until it got all the way to wherever we were when we met him, and somebody was there tipping, and it filled us up, and that's just the way it works. And so because you've been redeemed, because he's claimed you, because he's bought you out of sin and death, because he's washed you clean and given you a purpose and called you into the ministry of reconciliation that he came to perform and called his early disciples into, see, you have all the prerequisites to pour and fill empty vessels. As long as there's an empty vessel, God has supplied what we need to fill them. And you, along with me and all of us, are those that can just cry out, ask the Lord to work, and then he may say, well, you know, find some empty vessels. Find empty vessels and bring them. And then just take that little bit that you didn't think was much and just pour it. And you'll see empty vessels filled up and changed and brought into redemption. And it's what we're here for. The rest is kind of just peripheral, even though it's necessary. The meaning and the purpose is in the truth of God's Son and the redemption that he has worked for us and for all humanity. So pray for me. I'll pray for you. Let's ask for empty vessels. Let's ask the Lord to work. Let's ask him to manifest his power in our communities and to give us faith to go and look and see what we have, and then to just take it and pour it or break it and hand it out until everybody's filled. It's the way that he does things. So, Father, I ask you to just speak to us today, touch our hearts, encourage us, pour your love on each person here. Fill up the empty places. Touch the aching places, the hurting places, the doubtful places, and I ask you, Father, to just come and attack any shame that's trying to grab hold of any of us, because it's been taken away in Yeshua, and we are clean, and we belong to you, and you've made us righteous according to the riches of Yeshua. So strengthen us and enable us, Lord, to do what you've sent us to do, and strengthen our fellowship with each other. Help us to encourage each other, Lord, day to day, as long as it's called today, and to put our hope and faith in you and in nothing else. And just bless and be with everyone here, Lord. Yivarechecha Adonai v'yishmarecha Ya'er Adonai panevelecha v'echunecha Isa Adonai panevelecha v'yasem lecha Shalom.